Hello, everyone. Good evening. My name is Joe Disher, and I'm the Associate Artistic Director at the Shakespeare Theater in New Jersey. I'd like to welcome you to the theater on behalf of Bonnie J. Monti, our Artistic Director, and the entire staff and company for tonight's special event, Knaves, Thieves, and Treachers, an evening with Christopher Moore. Tonight, Chris will discuss his latest novel, Fool, and actors from the Shakespeare Theater Company will perform readings from the book as well as from Shakespeare's King Lear, the play upon which Fool is based. I'd like now to welcome our special guest to the stage. He is the author of over 10 popular novels, including You Suck, The Stupidest Angel, Fluke, The Lust Lizard of Melancholy Cove, and Lamb, The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal. The Daily News has said that Christopher Moore is absurd, quite endearingly so, though the sweetness embedded in his stories never undercuts the funny. And the Washington Post says his books deftly blend the surreal, occult, and even science fiction doings with laugh-out-loud satire of contemporary culture. He has been called the greatest satirist since Jonathan Swift, and a very sick man in the best sense of the word. Please welcome best-selling author Christopher Moore.
I was on an airplane, so the person next to me was going, oh my God. I can't see you guys at all. Every other time I talk, I can kind of look out and go, I have no idea who's here.
There's nobody here.
I'm going to go over here. Hang on a second.
Oh, there you are.
Thank you. I'm told, let's see, what do we got going here? I haven't rehearsed this. I've never done anything like this before, so it should be interesting. I'm told my peeps from my agency, Team Fucktard, is here. After our recent overtake of the Frankfurt Book Fair, where everybody in publishing in the whole world comes to listen to tell you, oh gosh, we love your books, or who are you? My agent held a reception for me, and the foreign rights director there, Sarah, who's a lovely woman, introduced me to people who would say things like, hello, I am your Bulgarian publisher. And then Sarah would walk away with her champagne flute like a Siamese cat all cross-eyed with a mouse in its mouth, and he'd say, you're on your own, dude. And then I'd be thinking, what do I know about Bulgaria that I can say to these people? So, Bulgar wheat is all I could think. It would be like saying this, yeah, it was like, oh, you're from America, we love your cheeseburgers. So, this is your Estonian agent. And I'm like, and you don't want it, the first thing out of your mouth, you don't want to be, I don't know where Estonia is. I couldn't find it on a map if someone threatened me. So anyway, welcome you guys if you're here. And then I think my HarperCollins people are here. I don't know where you guys are because I can't see you. But yeah. They're stoked after the release of that Sarah Palin book on Monday. It was $28.99 on Monday, and on Tuesday you could get it for $8.99. That's an interesting strategy. It's second down. What do? Punt. Actually, my people are William Morrow people because they're used to sort of there, it's, which a division of HarperCollins, they're used to denying that they did the HarperCollins books all the time. It's, no, we didn't do that one. You know, because HarperCollins is always like, yes, we did the Jenna Jameson book, the Tracy Lords book. there was this one, it was called, I can't remember, it was called like The Last Frontier or In the Butt or something like that. It was about, I can't remember, what was the name of that book? It was about a ballet dancer about, you know, in the butt. And the final surrender or something, and I was listening to the, what was it called?
Surrender.
Surrender, right. Dorothy, I believe, was her name. So, yeah, it was really interesting listening to the national salespeople talk about how they were going to sell, you know, Surrender, which I think should have been called In the Butt. Anyway, so welcome, you guys. Thanks for coming, all of you. What do we have? We got that. Okay, so we're going to do some, there's some wonderful actors here from the New Jersey Shakespeare Company, or the Shakespeare Company of New Jersey. I haven't gotten that right quite yet. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the book Fool, and they're going to read from it, dramatic readings or comic readings, depending on whether you guys laugh or not. We'll see how it goes. I haven't had a long tradition with Shakespeare. I've had sort of a semi-long tradition with the English people, based on the shitty cars that they built. My first car was a Ford Cortina, which had it had an advanced sensor for 1976, I guess, in that it could detect whenever I had saved $243, and then it would, because that's how much it cost. I wanted to buy a Smith Corona electric typewriter that was. Because there weren't computers then, shut up. And so I could write books and whatnot, and you guys could come and do this. And it was $243, and as soon as I would save $240, my Ford Cortina, my English Ford would break, and then I would have to take all my money to fix it. So I've been trying to get revenge on the Brits for about 30-something years, so this ought to do it. I didn't set out to write a Shakespeare book. I set out to write a book about a fool. Any of those of you who saw me when I was on the Fool book tour, you know that. And it was my editor, Jennifer Brown, who said, oh, no, it should be Lear's Fool. And then she went off happily to do whatever she does, and I spent 3 years trying to learn Shakespeare. To sort of bring you guys up to speed, I assume that you're not as ignorant as I was in all this, but King Lear is the story of, it's supposed to be Lear's most dire tragedy, in that even in Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet, there's some funny parts. Lear, not so much. And although I'm still looking for the humor in Titus Andronicus, but I suppose if, you know, someone getting their arms and tongue cut out is funny to you, it's a laugh riot. But anyway, King Lear is the story of an old king of Britain who, wanting to crawl to the grave unburdened, as he says, decides that he wants to divide his kingdom among his three daughters before he dies. And the way he sets about doing that is he holds court and he asks them, which of you loves me most? And he makes his decision based on that, and then he whines about it for five acts. And the fool in King Lear has a fairly small but important part. The part is to be the only character, really, that speaks truth to power. And when I came up with the idea of writing a book about a fool, it was because it seemed like the only people I was getting any sort of political truth from were comedians. They were the only ones that were saying, you know, these people are full of shit. And they were. And so that's basically the fool who's not even named in Shakespeare's play. I gave him a personality and a background and a sort of a special purpose, so to speak, which is to shag the three daughters. And so I'm going to bring out the actors from the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey, or the New Jersey Shakespeare Theater, or the Company of Shakespearean. Thanks, you guys. And they're going to illustrate what happens, I guess, counterpointing to Shakespeare's play. So because Shakespeare's Fool didn't even have a name, I gave my fool a name, Pocket. And this is the scene where Pocket is searching for his apprentice, Drool. I'll talk a little bit about Drool in a minute. He's on the battlements as everything's commencing for the play to start and for the drama to start, and he meets a young yeoman. So this is, "Hail Edmund, you bloody bastard."
Cordelia's chambers lay in the north tower, the quickest way there atop the outer wall. As I crossed over the great main gatehouse, a young spot-faced yeoman called,
"Hail, Earl of Gloucester!"
Below, the greybeard Gloucester and his retinue were crossing the drawbridge. "Hail, Edmund, you bloody bastard!"
"Begging your pardon, sirrah, but I'm told that Edmund is sensitive about his bastardy."
"Aye, yeoman, no need for prodding and jive to divine that prick's tender spot. He wears it on his sleeve." I jumped on the wall and waved Jones at the bastard, who was trying to wrench a bow and quiver from a knight who rode beside him.
"You horse and scallywag! You flesh turd! Drop stinking from the poxy arsehole of a hare-lipped harlot!"
"Too harsh, you reckon?"
"A bit."
"Sorry! Excellent hat, though, bastard." Edgar had two knights. Edgar and two knights were trying to restrain the bastard Edmund below. I jumped down from the wall.
"Haven't seen Drool, have you?" "In the great hall this morning, not since."
A call came around the top of the wall.
"The Duke of Cornwall and Princess Regan approach from the south."
Pack stockings. Cornwall. Polished greed and pure-born villainy. He'd dirk a nun for a farthing and short the coin for the fun of it.
"Don't worry, little one. The king will keep your hide whole."
"Aye, yeoman, he will. And if you call me little one in company, the king will have you walking watch on the frozen moat all winter."
"Sorry, sir. Just that, sir."
He slouched then, so as to seem not so irritatingly tall.
"Heard that tasty Princess Regan's a right bunny, cunning, eh?"
"You're new, aren't you?"
"Just 2 months in service."
"Advice then, young yeoman. When referring to the king's middle daughter, state that she is fair, speculate that she is pious, but unless you'd like to spend your watch looking for the box where your head is kept, resist the urge to wax ignorant on her naughty bits."
"Don't know what that means, sir."
"Speak not of Regan's sagacity, son. Cornwall has taken the eyes of men who have but looked upon the princess with the spark of lust."
"A fiend! I didn't know, sir. I'll say nothing."
"And neither shall I, good yeoman. Neither shall I. And thus alliances are made. Loyalty cemented. Pocket makes a friend." The boy was right about Regan, of course. And why I hadn't thought to call her Bunny Cunny myself, when I of all people should know. Well, as an artist, I must admit, I was envious of the invention.
It's so weird to hear that voice somewhere besides in my head. Thanks, you guys. Taking on King Lear was interesting. As many of you know, I went to England to look at medieval stuff and to try and get the history right, and it occurred to me pretty early on that the history couldn't be right. Shakespeare had gotten it wrong. King Lear lived, if he lived at all, 400 BC. There were no Norman castles, there were no dukes and earls and a whole hierarchy of royalty. Basically, there would have been a mud fortress, and that would have been where King Lear lived. So, and that sort of gave me license to do anything I wanted, and certainly with the fool being in very few scenes in the play, I could do anything I wanted with that too. So, it was deciding about the language, and that too was going to be a problem. Obviously, it wasn't going to be in medieval English. And if I had it in Elizabethan English, which you guys will see by contrast later on when they do two scenes, one from Lear and one from my book, how different the language actually is. It just had to sound like Elizabethan language. And it was okay if I stole a lot of stuff, which I did from, 16 different plays. Because Shakespeare stole King Lear. There was a play called The Tragedy of King Lear, L-E-I-R, that was played in London about 10 years before Shakespeare wrote King Lear. And strangely enough, it had the same plot. But the language wasn't as pretty, so I was able to do that. King Lear then went, there was sort of a lost, I don't think it was in the original portfolio of, or folio of Shakespeare's plays, so it had to be put together. And in, 1681, the first poet laureate of England, Nahum Tate, wrote a happy ending version of King Lear, wherein Lear lives and Cordelia marries Edmund and they off they go. But that's not how Shakespeare's play went, and it was restored in 1724 by Alexander Pope. Strangely enough, the happy ending stayed for 200 years and nobody did the Alexander Pope version of it. So until really the last century, nobody saw the Lear that Shakespeare wrote with that was the actual tragedy of King Lear. And so in the tradition of always having a happy ending whenever you come to an author guy event, oh wait, I've given too much away. No, that, there's no happy endings, I think you know that. Anyway, so it was up to me to sort of set it and develop these characters and so forth, and one of the characters that I didn't feel got developed enough was Cordelia, the youngest daughter. And so we see in this next scene, sort of Cordelia worried a little bit about what's going on around the castle, and Pocket is still in search of his assistant Drool. Now Drool is, he calls him a beef brain bloke the size of an ox, and he's basically inspired by Lenny from Of Mice and Men. I didn't like the way that book ended either. I'm a huge Shakespeare fan, but I'm a huge Steinbeck fan, but I thought, you know, the whole you should get really attached to these two guys who were buddies and going through the Depression West, and then the little guy kills the big guy. And I thought, no. In my version, the big guy gets laid a lot. So, which for some reason the New Jersey Shakespeare Company wouldn't let us act out. So what we're going to see is the preparation of the court for King Lear leaving his legacy, a scene called Marrying Me Off.
Cordelia's private solar lay at the top of the north tower on the outer wall, up a narrow spiral staircase lit only with the crosses of arrow loops. I could hear giggling as I topped the stairs.
So I am of no worth, if not on the arm or in the bed of some buffoon in a codpiece.
You called, said I, stepping into the room, codpiece in hand.
Pocket!
Cordelia sat at the center of the circle of girls, holding court as such. Her hair down, blonde curls to her waist, a simple gown of lavender linen loosely laced. She stood and approached me.
You honor us, fool. Did you hear rumors of small animals to hurt? Or were you hoping to accidentally surprise me in my bath again?
I was lost, my lady.
A dozen times.
Finding my way is not my strong suit.
Out, 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 ladies. Give me peace with my fool so that I might devise some punishment for him.
Punishment for what?
I don't know yet. But by the time I've thought of the punishment, I'm sure there'll be an offense.
I blush at your confidence.
And I at your humility.
Cordelia is not 10 years my junior. I'm exactly not sure of my own age. 17 summers has she seen, and as the youngest of the king's daughters, she's always been treated as if fragile as spun glass. But, sweet thing that she is, her bark could frighten a mad badger. Shall I disrobe for my punishment? Flagellation? Fellation? Whatever, I am your willing penitent, lady.
No more of that, Pocket. I need your counsel, or at least your commiseration. My sisters are coming to the castle.
Unfortunately, they have arrived.
Oh, that's right. Albany and Cornwall want to kill you. Bad luck, that. Anyway, they are coming to the castle, as is Gloucester and his sons. Goodness, they want to kill you as well.
Rough critics.
And a dozen other nobles, as well as the Earl of Kent, are here. Kent doesn't want to kill you, does he?
Not that I know of, but it is only lunchtime.
Right. Do you know why they are all coming?
To corner me like a rat in a barrel.
Barrels do not have corners, Pocket.
Does seem a lot of bother for killing one small, if tremendously handsome fool.
It's not about you, you dolt. It's about me.
Well, even less effort to kill you. How many can it take to snap your scrawny neck? I worry that Drool will do it by accident someday. You haven't seen him, have you?
Father is marrying me off.
Nonsense. Who would have you?
Edgar of Gloucester has always wanted me. And the Prince of France and Duke of Burgundy are already here to pay me troth.
Those two? Edgar? No. I'm shaken. Cordelia? Married? Would one of them take her away? It was unjust, unfair, wrong. Why, she had never even seen me naked. But why would they want to troth you? I mean, for the night, sure, who wouldn't troth you cross-eyed? Permanently, I think not.
I'm a bloody princess, Pocket.
Precisely, what good are princesses? Dragon food and ransom markers. Spoiled brats to be bartered for real estate.
Oh, no, dear fool. You forget that sometimes a princess becomes a queen.
Ha! Princesses. What worth are you if your father has to tack a dozen countries to your bum to get those French pouffeters to look at you?
Oh, and what worth a fool? Oh, what's the ransom for a jester, Pocket? A bucket of warm spittle?
Pierced to the core I am. I bleed. I suffer. I die on the forked lance of your words.
You do not.
No, stay back. Bloodstains will never come out of linen. They are stubborn with your cruelty and guilt.
Pocket, stop it now.
You have killed me, lady, most dead. Let it always be said that this humble fool brought joy to all whom he met.
No one will say that.
Child! I grow weak. No breath. But I want you to know that despite your vicious nature and your freakishly large feet, I have always... And then I die. Bloody fucking brilliantly, I'd say, too. Hint of a shudder at the end as death's chilly hand grabbed my knob.
What? You have always what?
I said nothing, being dead. And not a little exhausted from all the bleeding and gasping. Truth be told, under the jest, I felt I'd taken a bolt to the heart.
You're absolutely no help at all.
That was awesome. I don't want to detract from that. I'll just shut up. So you can see there's sort of a relationship develops between this. You don't. We don't get to see the relationship with the other two sisters because they're naked. But the whole scene, the whole play is set off by this phenomenally, I guess it's the catalytic act of the play, but it's basically the point where Lear makes this decision. And it's something that, rather than give too much introduction to it, our players are going to do Shakespeare's version and then my version. And you can make your own judgment about what I decided to do as far as how to write a novel about it as opposed to have it performed on stage and how I really thought it was kind of a nitwit idea on Lear's part. But also how the guy who turns out to be the real bad guy of King Lear is Edmund. And Shakespeare breaking a law that we as fiction writers learn, which is don't have characters with the same letter beginning their first name because it confuses people, has two brothers in the Gloucester family, one named Edmund and one named Edgar. And Edmund is the bad one and Edgar is the good one. No, wait, yes, that's right. I swear, even in editing the book, we'd go, is this Cornwall? There's like a million characters in the play, and you have to keep track of them because they're all named after counties and stuff. And anyway, so this next scene is from King Lear. It's Act 1, Scene 1, the seminal catalytic scene of King Lear.
we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we, unburdened, crawl toward death. Tell me, my daughters, which of you shall we say doth love us most, that we, our largest bounty, may extend where nature doth with merit challenge? Goneril, our eldest born, speak first.
Sir, I love you more than word can wield the matter. Dearer than eyesight, space and liberty, beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life. With grace, health, beauty, honor, as much as child e'er loved or father found. A love that makes breath poor and speech unable. Beyond all manner of so much, I love you.
What shall Cordelia speak? Love and be silent.
Of all these bounds, even from this line to this, with shadowy forests and with champaigns riched, with plenteous rivers and wide-skirted meads, we make thee lady. Thine and Albany's issues be this perpetual. What says our second daughter, our dearest Regan, wife of Cornwall?
I am made of that self-metal as my sister, and prize me at her worth. In my true heart, I find she names my very deed of love. Only she comes too short that I profess myself an enemy to all other joys which the most precious square of sense possesses, and find I am alone felicitate in your dear highness' love.
Then poor Cordelia, and yet not so, since I am sure my love is more ponderous than my tongue.
To thee and thine hereditary ever remain this ample third of our fair kingdom, no less in space, validity, and pleasure than that conferred on Goneril. Now, our joy, although our last and least, what can you say to draw a third more opulent than your sisters? Speak.
Nothing, my lord.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again.
Unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more nor less.
How now, Cordelia, mend your speech a little, lest you mar your fortunes.
But my lord, you have begot me, bred me, and loved me. I return those duties back as all right fit. Obey you, love you, and most honor you. Why have my sisters husbands if they say they love you all? Happily when I shall wed, well, that lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Surely I shall never marry like my sisters, to love my father all.
But goes thy part with this?
Aye, my good lord.
So young, yet so untender.
So young, my lord, and true.
Let it be so. Let truth then be thy dower. But by the sacred radiance of the sun, by all the operations of the orbs from whom we do exist and cease to be, here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity, and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me, hold from thee forever.
Good my liege.
Peace, Kent. Come not between the dragon and his wrath.
I loved her most, and thought to set my rest upon her kind nursery.
Kent, avoid my sight! Cornwall, Albany, with my two daughters, dowers the jest that had. Let pride, which she calls plainness, marry her. Ourself by monthly course, with reservations, of 100 knights, by you to be sustained, shall our abode make with you by Duke Churn. Only we shall retain the name and all the addition to a king.
Royal Lear, whom I have ever honored as my king, loved as my father, as my master followed, as my great patron Thorn in my prayer.
The bow is bent and drawn, make from the shaft.
Let it fall, rather, that a fork invade the region of my heart. Be kept unmannerly when Lear is mad. What wouldst thou do, old man?
Kent on my life no more.
My life I never held but as a pawn to wage against thine enemies. Ne'er fear to lose it, thy safety being moted.
Out of my sight.
See better, Lear, and let me still remain the true blank of thine eye.
Hear me, recreant. On thine allegiance, hear me. 5 days do we allot thee for provision to shield thee from disasters of the world, and on the 6th to turn thy hated back upon our kingdom. If on the 10th day following thy banished trunk be found in our dominions, that moment is thy death. Away! This shall not be revoked.
Fare thee well, king. Sith thus thou wilt appear, freedom lives hence, and banishment is here. The gods to their dear shelter take thee, maid, that justly thinkst and hast most rightly said.
Round after the tradition of some long-forgotten king. Kent took his place near the king's throne, and I stood with some yeomen to the side of the fire. Fools do not have a place at the table. Most times I served at the foot of the king, providing quips, criticisms, and brilliant observations through the meal, but only after he had called for me. Lear had not called for a week. He came into the room, head up, scowling at each of his guests, until his eye lit on Cordelia, and he smiled. He motioned for everyone to sit, and they did.
Edmund, fetch the princes of France and Burgundy.
Edmund bowed to the king and back toward the main entrance of the hall, then looked to me, winked, and motioned for me to come join him. Dread rose in my chest like a black serpent. What had the bastard done? I should have cut his throat when I'd had the chance. What have you wrought, bastard?
Only what you wanted, fool. Your princess will have no husband.
What did you say to the king?
I heard the princesses speaking amongst themselves about their affections for their father earlier in the day, and was enlightened to their character. I merely hinted to the king that he might ease his burden with the same knowledge.
What knowledge?
Go find out, fool. I'm off to fetch Cordelia's suitors.
And he was away. The guard held the door, and I slipped back into the hall into a spot near the table. The king, it seemed, had only then finished a roll call of sorts, naming each of his friends, his family at court, proclaiming his affection for each, and in the cases of Kent and Gloucester, recalling their long history of battles and conquests together.
I am old, and my burdens of responsibility and property weigh heavily on me. So to avoid conflict in the future, I propose to divide my kingdom among younger strengths now, so I may crawl to the grave light of heart.
What better than a light-hearted grave crawl? I said softly to Cornwall, villainous twat that he is. I crouched between he and his Duchess Regan. Princess Regan, tall, fair, raven-haired, with a weakness for plunging red velvet gowns and another for rascals. Both grievous faults, had they not played out so pleasurably for this teller of tales.
Oh, Pocket, did you get the stuffed dates I sent you?
And generous to a fault as well. Shh, bunny cunny. Father is speaking. Cornwall drew his dagger and I moved along the table to Goneril's side.
These properties and powers I will divide between my sons-in-law, the Duke of Albany and Duke of Cornwall, and that suitor who takes the hand of my beloved Cordelia. But, so I may determine who shall have the most bounteous share, I ask of my daughters, which of you loves me most? Goneril, my eldest born, speak first.
No pressure, pumpkin.
I have this fool.
With a great smile and no little grace, she made her way around the table, bowing to each of the guests as she went. I slid into her chair. A handsome creature she is, said I to the Duke. That one breast, the way it juts a bit to the side. When she's naked, I mean. Doesn't bother you at all? Make you wonder what it's looking at over there? It's a bit like a wall-eyed man you think's always talking to someone else.
Hush, fool,
said Albany. She's nearly a score older, years older than Goneril, goatish and dull, methinks, but somewhat less of a scoundrel than the average noble. I do not loathe him. But mind you, it's obviously part of the pair, not some breast errant off on a quest of its own. I like a bit of asymmetry in a woman. It's not like you're shagging a hunchback or anything. I mean, once she's on her back, it's hard to get either one of them to look you in the eye.
Shut up!
Barked Goneril. Having turned her back on her father, which one is never supposed to do, in order to scold me. Not a clumsy etiquette, that.
Sorry, go on! Sir, I love you more than words can say. I love you more than eyesight, space, and liberty. I love you beyond anything that can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life itself, with grace, health, beauty, and honor, as much as any child or father loved. So I love thee, a love that takes my breath away and makes me scarcely able to speak. I love you above all things, even pie.
Said it. I was relatively sure it was not my voice, as it didn't come from the normal hole in my face. And Jones had been silent as well. Cordelia? I scooted out of Goneril's chair and scampered to the junior princess's side, staying low to avoid attention or flying cutlery.
Bloody buggering bullocks!
What? Well, Sirrah, lovable as thou art, the lady's profession strains credibility. It's no secret how much the bitch loves pie.
Silence! Chamberlain! Bring me the man!
The distraction had worked. The king's ire had turned from Cordelia to me.
Ouch!
Tart?
Knave?
Harpy?
Rodent?
Whore?
Whoremonger?
Now, do you have to pay to be a whoremonger? Because strictly speaking, I've... The king pointed to the map with a bejeweled dagger.
All these lands, from here to here, with rich farmlands, bounteous rivers, and deep forests, I do grant to Goneril and her husband Albany, and to their offspring in perpetuity. Now we must hear from our second daughter, dearest Regan, wife to Cornwall. Regan
made her way to the center of the floor, looking down at her older sister Goneril as she passed, as if to say, I'll show you. She raised her arms out to her sides, trailing the long velvet sleeves down to the floor, so she described the shape of a grand and bosomy crucifix. She looked to the ceiling as if drawing inspiration from the heavenly orbs themselves, and then pronounced,
what she said.
Verily, was echoed around the room. Regan seemed to realize that she should probably go on.
My sister has expressed my thoughts exactly, as if she may have looked at my notes even before we here entered. Except I love thee more. In the list of all senses, all fall short. I am touched by nothing but your love.
She bowed then, looking up a bit to see if anyone was buying it.
I'm going to be sick.